Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Americans already spend too much time at work, and that means a largely sedentary lifestyle, sitting at a desk all day, which is unhealthy. Prolonged inactivity has been identified with obesity, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. But a new study suggests that employees who are enrolled in a workplace health intervention program could turn that around. Joining us in the studio is Professor of Human Nutrition at Ohio State University and lead author of the study, Dr. Carla Miller. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a question of where you get your intervention ultimately. The study suggested that the workplace can be more effective delivery service for health interventions, right?
That's correct. There have been very few worksite interventions that have targeted specifically people with prediabetes. There are a lot of worksite wellness programs in general, and OSU has a great program. Mm-hmm. But this study really targeted people with prediabetes. And prediabetes means that people have a blood glucose level or blood sugar level that's slightly above normal, but it's not quite high enough to be classified as type 2 diabetes. But what we know about prediabetes is that people with prediabetes are at much greater risk for going on to develop type 2 diabetes.
Typically, what do we know about the percentages that do?
1 in 3 adults in the U.S. have prediabetes.
And how many of them are likely to go into full-blown diabetes?
Oh, I don't know the exact percentage, but over time, eventually, probably the vast majority of them will go on to develop diabetes over several years.
If untreated. Right. And so what do we mean by an intervention program? What's the difference between an intervention program and a wellness program?
Well, this was an intervention program, like I said, that specifically targeted people with prediabetes.
Okay.
We met as a group every week for 16 weeks. And so a lot of wellness programs are conducted individually or they're conducted via telephone coaching.
Okay.
But this was a face-to-face group meeting in small groups of employees. And we met every week for 16 weeks, which is also fairly intensive. Many programs don't offer that level of support. But we know from previous wellness programs and previous weight loss programs in general that people often need a period of time to begin to develop these habits of eating more healthy and becoming more physically active. And the group support is vital because the participants will tell you that that really helps them stay on track.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how workplace interventions can achieve a lot of goals when it comes to, in this particular case and in this particular study, helping people with pre-diabetes conditions. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what's the magic about workplace? Couldn't you get group interventions, group counseling, that kind of thing over a period of time?
We could, but you know, adults spend so much of their time, employed adults spend so much of their time at the work site, and we're all busy. So can we take advantage of this natural environment that people spend the vast majority of their waking hours in at the work site and help them develop a healthy lifestyle? There have been very few, as I said, work site programs that have targeted people with prediabetes specifically, and this study shows that it's possible to do that.
So you tell us how the study was undertaken, how you identified them, and how they participated in this study.
So to be eligible for the study, they needed to have a glucose level between 100 and 125, which is that prediabetes range. Normal glucose is less than 100, and type 2 diabetes is defined as a glucose of 126 or above. So they had to be kind of in that sweet spot of 100 to 125. And then we brought people together in small groups of about 8 to 12 people, primarily at lunchtime during the lunch hour. We came together as a group and a life coach.
Once a week
mm-hmm. for 16 weeks, and a lifestyle coach facilitated the group sessions. The intervention was designed to be a reduced calorie, primarily by lowering fat intake and becoming more physically active, trying to gain 150 minutes a week of physical activity and eating a relatively low-fat diet to lower calorie intake. We really encouraged people to track or self-monitor what they're eating and how much physical activity they're engaged in, because we know that self-monitoring process is by far the most effective strategy people can use to really help them become aware of what are they doing and how are these changes influencing their diet.
And then would they report back to the group?
They would. So they would write write, keep a written record of what they ate and how much physical activity they got and turn that in every week. The lifestyle coach would review it, provide tips, feedback, answer questions, come up with some perhaps alternative strategies they could do to become more healthy.
Were participants paid?
No, they were not.
So there wasn't that additional incentive then?
Right. This was not paid. This was funded by the National Institutes of Health, so they were not paid. They didn't have to pay to be a part of the study.
And how did you study it then? So what were you studying? What were you looking for? Lower weights, lower glucose levels, that kind of a thing?
Right. So we measured their weight, their blood pressure, their glucose, their blood cholesterol levels, what they ate, how much physical activity they engaged in at the beginning, but right before the program started and immediately after the program. And then 3 months later, after the program was finished, when they didn't have any contact from us. So we did assessments three times.
Mm-hmm. The relationship between nutrition and diabetes, that was part of the conversation?
Yes. So during the group sessions, they received a lot of skill building on how to lower the fat content of their diet, what to do when you eat out, how do you handle this during the holidays, what if you go to someone's house and eat, how can you handle those kinds of situations diplomatically and yet still try to eat a healthy diet?
And you said you went to them 3 months after the 16 weeks period ended.
Right.
And you found that there were sustained benefits.
Well, they were able to sustain their weight loss for the most part. Their diet did begin to creep a little bit up higher in fat, but they were able to maintain their weight and their glucose levels did stay down three months later.
What kind of weight loss did you see?
On average, for the group as a whole, we had a 5.5% weight loss, and we know that at 5% point is generally where risk for type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Often people see a lot of improvement in those risk factors for disease at the 5% weight loss point, and that's what we did. We achieved 5.5% overall.
What about stress?
Well, many people eat in response to stress, and they find that when they're stressed, they turn to comfort foods, which often are high-calorie and high-fat foods. So stressful situations are difficult for many people, and we did talk about effective strategies for stress management during the lifestyle program.
And when you talked about who paid for it, I'm wondering how much does a program like this cost, this kind of intervention?
I can't answer that specifically because we had funding from the National Institutes of Health to pay for the lifestyle coaches and the measurements that happened before and after the study, and people like myself who are involved in creating the study to begin with.
Right.
So, if people had to pay for it, I don't know what the market rate would be.
Because I'm trying to figure out the practicality of workplace intervention programs like this and how realistic they are.
Well, there is some cost, of course, for the lifestyle coach. Clearly, that would probably be an employee at most work sites. It would be someone with training in health education or nutrition or physical activity. So that person's salary would probably need to be covered. But when you look at if we can prevent people from developing diabetes over the long term, it likely would reduce employer costs. We didn't do that part of the study. That still needs to be done. We still need to follow participants long term to determine if we can ultimately delay diabetes.
And thereby lower costs.
Lower costs for the employer.
Right, when it comes to healthcare. But, all right, as we move from a healthcare, employer-based healthcare system to national healthcare, where's the incentives for that?
Taxpayers. If all of us can save money in national healthcare costs, that's going to eventually have an effect for all of us. People with type 2 diabetes develop a lot of other serious illnesses. And so diabetes is a very, very costly condition. So if we can even delay that by a number of years, there was a very large study done before this study, of course, called the Diabetes Prevention Program. And that study found they had sites, I think 16 sites across the nation, and they found that they were able to prevent diabetes for up to 15 years. And so if we can reduce type 2 diabetes and many of the complications that are associated with that, we're talking about a great reduction in healthcare costs for the nation as a whole.
What do people do outside of this kind of an intervention at work? What are they typically doing? Nothing? Are they maybe going to Weight Watchers or someplace like that? Or is there any other way to get help?
Well, I can speak about OSU specifically. Uh-huh. OSU does have Weight Watchers programs available to employees on campus, and they also do provide health coaching to people with some of the chronic conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, asthma. So you can receive health coaching through over the telephone primarily mm-hmm. to talk about the management of your disease. So that is offered to OSU employees. I'm sure at other work sites, you know, Weight Watchers at work is viable. Many mm-hmm. places of employment do provide that opportunity.
But there's something about people being able to talk to each other.
Absolutely. And I think there's something about, you know, at OSU, we're a community. Sometimes we don't, but we all have this common bond of working for this great employer and coming together and realizing that you're not the only one who's struggling with eating healthfully and getting physical activity. Uh-huh. We're all in the same boat. We all are pretty sedentary at work. And so coming together and learning from each other and sharing, well, this is what I did and it worked for me and might work for you too. That is really helpful. The participants tell us that's very beneficial for them.
Just emotionally to...
Yes, and keeping them on track and realizing that other people have figured out how to do this and are providing that emotional support as well.
How much of the nutrition equation is a function of our lifestyles now, not just the fact that we're at work so much, but that because we're at work and we're busy doing so many other things, we're not cooking?
A lot. Yeah. Cooking has gone down dramatically in this country. We eat out a lot more than we used to. And as we know, when you eat out, you can't control how it's prepared. So it tends to be higher in salt. Sometimes it's higher in fat.
It's probably not good for you is what we were always told.
Well, and the portions are so big. Yes. So we spend a lot of time talking about portion control. That doesn't mean giving up your favorite foods. It just means eating them in smaller portions. So eating out, the big challenge is the portions are so large when we eat out.
And then of course there's the you said 150 minutes a week of increased physical activity.
That's
huge.
The goal.
That's big.
Well, that's 30 minutes five times a week.
Yeah.
If you think about it that way, and it doesn't have to be 30 minutes all at one time.
Mm-hmm.
We try to have it be at least 10 minutes. But if you can get up and if you have a 15 minute break at work, take a short walk, you know, instead of sitting and emailing somebody, get up and go talk to them in their office. You know, I have, faculty members who are next door to me, and it's so easy just to send an email, but to actually get up and go talk to them. So if you can get at least 10-minute segments of walking or some physical activity, but 30 minutes five times a week, it doesn't have to be all at once. It can be in 3 10-minute segments. That's fairly easy for most people to do.
What part of this process of study is going to involve employers and educating employers about the importance of this? Because sometimes you don't get the buy-in from them if you want to take a 15-minute walk.
Yes, that's important. But, you know, that's where when we really do the cost-effectiveness studies, which we did not do as part of the study, we need to do a second study to really mm-hmm. look at the cost-effectiveness. I think if you can share with employers the cost-effectiveness of it, that over the long term, we know from studies like the broader diabetes prevention program, that medication costs reduce because people don't need to take all these medications to control their blood pressure.
They're not gone from work as often?
That's right. Absenteeism reduced. And something called presenteeism, which we measured in this study, is workplace productivity and quality. Mm. It increased in this study. So workforce quality improves, workforce productivity increases, absenteeism decreases, medication costs decrease, illness decreases, number of sick days decrease. We know from other studies that all of those factors can improve, which ultimately improves employer costs, healthcare costs.
Dr. Carla Miller, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Carla Miller, professor of human nutrition at Ohio State University. She's also the lead author in a new study on how workplace interventions have improved the health of people with pre-diabetic conditions. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Cholesterol levels in adults reached a 15-year low in the last 2 years, according to a report published last week by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But the CDC also found that 1 in 5 children and teens have some form of abnormal blood cholesterol reading. That's not good. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Joining us now to explain the good news for adults' decline is Mount Carmel Clinical Cardiovascular Specialist, Dr. Timothy Timko. Welcome to the show, Dr. Timko.
Thank you. I appreciate to be on this show.
First of all, can you just tell us, you know, give us a little primer on what cholesterol is?
Cholesterol is in the body, and it's mainly broken down into good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. And the good cholesterol actually removes blockages, and the bad cholesterol can actually cause blockages that can lead to a heart attack and a stroke.
Why the decline in the bad cholesterol in adults? What do we know about that?
Well, I think the major decline is due to the increased use of statin agents, which are very, very effective and fairly well tolerated.
Is something like a statin agent necessary, or is there other lifestyle changes that could be used instead of that?
Well, we always want to start with lifestyle modification, which usually means a healthy diet, low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, weight reduction, and a exercise program where you're trying to exercise 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just talking about that as far as nutrition goes and exercise in terms of pre-diabetic conditions. So the increase in statins are behind the decline in high cholesterol in adults. That's good news. How do we raise those good cholesterol levels?
That's a very good question, and it's not easy to raise the good cholesterol, but the things that patients can do is if they smoke, not smoking is probably the best thing to raise the good cholesterol. Exercise will also raise the good cholesterol, and the statins have a mild effect in raising the good cholesterol. That's not their main reason that we use them, but they have that effect.
Why does something like smoking affect cholesterol levels?
Smoking affects a lot of things, and I don't actually know the molecular reasons of why that mm-hmm. occurs, but there is a cause and effect.
And if we've been told traditionally to limit the amount of cholesterol in our diets, but what we would eat has changed over time.
Yes, and you bring up a good point. The majority of cholesterol in our bodies is generated by the liver. So a lot of it is hereditary, and even though you can make an impact with diet, it's very difficult to make a large impact unless you go to a very strict vegetarian diet. So to affect the cholesterol levels in the majority of patients that have high cholesterol, it does sometimes take medical therapy.
Hmm. And what are the symptoms of high cholesterol? What's the outcome if it's untreated? Is that the stroke?
Well, one of the problems is that high cholesterol doesn't cause symptoms until a final event like a heart attack or a stroke. So patients are walking around frequently with high cholesterol and they don't even know it. That's why it's important to follow up with physicians and have a cholesterol level checked to see if they're in an area that needs to be treated.
You know, I was happened to be in an emergency room recently and overheard a physician talking with a patient who was brought in for something that was related to cholesterol. And she said, "So what is your cholesterol typically at?" And he says, "I have no idea. I've never had it done before. I've never had it measured."
Yes, and I think it's important to know your numbers. And if your numbers are good, it should be checked about every 5 years. But if it's abnormal, and the thing about cholesterol is you have to take the cholesterol level in conjunction with other heart risk factors. So just because one patient may have a cholesterol level that looks good for them, it may be bad for another patient.
So this study that says that the bad cholesterol levels in adults are going down, and it's largely due, as you said, to statins. Is that good news, or is there a sense out there that more needs to be done? I mean, do they need to come down farther, or what?
There's very good data out recently that the lower we push the cholesterol levels, the better the outcomes are as far as reducing heart attack and stroke and bypass surgery. So I think we have done fairly well in reducing the high cholesterol in the United States, but we have a long ways to go because only about half of the patients who should be treated are being treated right now.
Okay, so only half are being treated.
Yes.
And that's because they don't know that their levels are high, or are they not good at taking their medications? What is it?
I think it's a combination of multiple things. It's definitely patients don't know their levels. Patients are not following up with physicians or seeing their annual visits. And compliance. A lot of times patients will come into my office and I'll find out they stopped their medication. I ask why, and they say, well, they talked to a neighbor, and their neighbor told them they shouldn't take it. And that's where it's important for me to go over some facts about the statin agents, the benefits, and with the patients to reassure them and to try to make sure that they take the appropriate medications.
What are the concerns about statins?
Well, the probably the most frequent side effect, which occurs maybe in about 10 to 15% of patients, is usually muscle aches. But the problem is that as we get older, everybody gets muscle aches.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take that in conjunction with the medication that they're on and sometimes take them off the statin agent maybe for 2 weeks to see if that improves. And if it's related to the medication, it usually improves fairly rapidly. And then we may re-challenge them with a different statin agent. So that's the main concern, the statin agents.
You said people said their name, you know, they talk to somebody and they say go off it. Is that common that people just go off medication like that without consulting with a physician?
Unfortunately, it's very common. Sometimes it's related to information they get from other people or on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a cost issue. And sometimes it's they just don't think it's helping them because they don't feel any better. But the issue is that statin agents don't make you feel better. They're trying to prevent a heart attack or a stroke.
And what about cost?
Fortunately for statin agents, we're very lucky right now that the two statin agents that are recommended right now are Crestor or Lipitor. And they're the most potent and most effective. Lipitor is now generic, so it's usually about $4 a month. And in Columbus, Ohio here, and maybe other areas, it's been giving out for free at Myers. So I tell patients that cost is not an issue anymore when it comes to statin agent.
Okay. Well, if anyone has any questions or comments, you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Timothy Timko. He's a Mount Carmel Clinical Cardiovascular Specialist. 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. That's a probably a tough thing for a lot of people, Dr. Timko, is that they don't feel better because they don't necessarily feel badly if they have high cholesterol in the first place, right?
You're exactly right.
So it's just a matter of being tested for it to prevent something in the future. And that's harder to, do you think that one of the reasons why the statins are helping more now is because people are more educated about it? They're more aware of what the issues are?
Yes, I think they are. And it's had a major impact. The incidence of heart attacks and strokes over the past 10 to 15 years continues to fall in the United States.
Is there a difference between men and women?
There is. For several things. If we talk about the levels, because of the estrogens that women have, they usually have a higher HDL and a lower LDL until they reach menopause. And then it changes at that time. And that's one of the reasons why women, on average, have heart attacks about 10 years later than men.
And as far as staying on your meds and that kind of a thing, is there a gender difference on that score?
Yes, there is. Women have a tendency to stay on their medications better than men do.
That's interesting. Any promising research related to high cholesterol in better ways to treat it or other ways than statins?
There's a very exciting medication that has just come out. It's in a family called the PCSK9 inhibitor. But kind of the short of it is, it's an injection once or twice a month, And really the only side effects that have been seen is at the site of the injection is a little irritation. It dramatically reduces your cholesterol level without the muscle aches and pains that some people get. The one thing we don't know yet is, has it reduced the risk of a stroke and a heart attack? Even though you dramatically reduce the cholesterol, we think that's going to happen, but we're just waiting to see. In the future, it looks like that may be made into a pill and possibly even a vaccine.
A vaccine that anybody could take?
Correct. But that's about 10 to 20 years away.
Anita in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Timothy Timko. Hi, Anita.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good. He had mentioned the vegetarian diet, and I was wondering if he could just touch on that in terms of what is it about the vegetables opposed to not eating any type of meat or dairy that would help with high cholesterol.
Yeah, hi, Anita. That's
hi.
A very good question. And the eating the vegetables, I think, is more important that you're not eating the meat and the fat in the meat. There's a physician many years ago, Dean Ornish, and it's his diet that really has shown to have reversibility of blocked arteries. Unfortunately, in about 20 years, I've only had two patients and have been able to stick with it because it is a very, very rigorous diet.
You're talking about a vegan diet.
Vegetarian.
Okay, vegetarian. It doesn't have to be vegan.
Correct.
Okay. All right, Anita, thanks a lot for that call. Kendra in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kendra.
Hi. The doctor mentioned that one of the side effects of the statins could be muscle aches. Is there anything that can be done to maybe combat that side effect, like staying more hydrated, drinking more water?
It looks like there's not anything that's effective to prevent it. They did have a vitamin called CoQ10, and they felt that this may be a benefit, but they did a large placebo-controlled trial, and they found out that it was no better than placebo as far as preventing muscle aches. So to answer your question is, unfortunately, hydration and different things like that won't prevent the muscle aches.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Timothy Timko, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your help.
Thank you.
It's Dr. Timothy Timko. He's a Mount Carmel Clinical Cardiovascular Specialist. More Wellness Wednesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Cognitive behavioral therapy. It's designed to help children, teens, and young adults deal with anxiety, stress, and depression. The Journal of School Health recently published a study of one innovative health program shown to reduce depression and unhealthy weights in teens. It's called COPE. That's short for Creating Opportunities for Personal Empowerment. Joining us in the studio is Dean of the Ohio State University College of Nursing and lead author of the study, Dr. Bernadette Melnick. Welcome back.
Good morning.
As always, for one thing, I wanted to ask you right off the bat, as far as cognitive behavioral therapy goes, I kind of threw that out there as if everybody knows what it is. Of course, we don't. And I wanted you to describe that. And also, why is it that that works for teens and young adults and children so well?
For one, cognitive behavior therapy is a type of therapy that emphasizes techniques that teach people how we think directly relates to how we feel and how we behave. As part of teaching people those skills, we teach the ABCs. A stands for activating event. It's a stressor that usually triggers a negative thought. You may have experienced one this morning.
This recently, yes.
Exactly. So what we teach the teens to do is to monitor for those activating events and negative beliefs that follow and stop them. Turn them around to a positive belief that leads to feeling better and making healthier choices in terms of behavior.
And that's more effective with young people? They just respond better or not?
No.
Okay.
It's actually great for adults.
For everybody.
And older adults as well. But here's the big issue. We have long thought you had to be, say, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, or a psychiatrist, a mental health counselor to do cognitive behavior therapy.
Okay.
And you do. But what I did was take the key concepts from cognitive behavior therapy and pare them down to what I call cognitive behavior skills building. So I can teach teachers, nurses, social workers, how to deliver these skills without them being a trained mental health therapist. So I don't call it CBT. I call it cognitive behavioral skills building.
When I've learned about cognitive behavioral therapy in the past, there was a machine involved where you would actually watch what, you know, you'd have the stressor and then you'd see what it did to your body.
Right, exactly. Part of teaching people these skills is also teaching them emotional regulation, like what you're talking about now. How to monitor for signs and symptoms of emotional arousal or distress, and then how to pick those symptoms up and regulate them. Cognitive behavior therapy is a very strong evidence-based treatment for depression and anxiety, but so few people get it due to the shortage of mental health therapists and psychiatric providers. It's unfortunate, but so many psychiatric nurse practitioners are very focused and in demand to do medication management. But we have to keep in mind, medication alone might not be effective for people. We have shown through multiple studies that cognitive behavior therapy or skills building, which I call what I teach and do, really drops depression, anxiety, anger, improve self-esteem, and healthy behaviors.
It's called COPE, Creating Opportunities for Personal Empowerment. How did you select participants for this study?
Right. Well, I always think about how can we get effective interventions to the greatest number of people who need them. So I thought if I could teach teachers in high schools how to deliver this program, we could reach so many students. So what we did was we had a day of training with the teachers. We gave manuals to them that every student got that had these skills in them. And the teachers actually integrated this into the health course of the students one day a week for 15 weeks.
And did the students know they were doing it?
The students knew they were in a study.
Oh, okay.
And were receiving one of two healthy lifestyle programs.
Okay.
So they knew that, but they didn't know exactly
what component
of it. Components were in those two different healthy lifestyle programs.
So what did the component from the COPE program look like to them? I mean, what were the teachers saying to them?
So the teachers were delivering these skills. They were teaching the students the ABCs. They were teaching emotional regulation, how to solve problems, how to goal set, how to communicate more effectively, how to cope with stressors. Those are all important components of cognitive behavior therapy. Again, these are lifelong coping skills that every child and teen should be taught in America.
And is there a difference when you're raised in a way that helps you cope better and effectively, or is versus being taught in a classroom?
Yeah, I think one, there are people who are born with more resiliency,
okay,
more coping capacity, for instance. But these are skills that can be taught. The issue is a lot of parents, a lot of adults never learn these skills. So the kids don't get them because the role modeling of these skills aren't happening in families. In our study, which was, I think, really cool, what we found is we asked the students to take home newsletters, four of them, to their parents. Mm-hmm. And go over what they were learning in their course.
How old were the students again? I'm sorry.
14 to 16 years of age. Mm-hmm. These were mainly 9th and 10th graders.
Okay.
They took these newsletters home. We saw parents change behaviors as a result of what their teens were teaching them.
How did you see that?
Through evaluations, okay, from both the parents as well as the teenagers.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Bernadette Melnick. She's Dean of Ohio State University's College of Nursing and also the lead author of a study on how it was just published recently in the Journal of School Health. And it's an innovative health program shown to reduce depression and unhealthy weights in teens. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And McLean in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, McLean.
Hey there, Ann and Dr. Wilna. I just wanted to ask you two to comment and ruminate a little on the recent kind of studies concerning meditation and that style of self-mental discipline and how that might relate to cognitive behavioral therapy. And, you know, the similarities between those two, pretty interesting aspect of meditation that I've heard of. I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks,
sure,
ladies.
Dr. Melnick is nodding her head, so go ahead.
Yes. So there is a therapy called mindfulness integrated cognitive behavior therapy that integrates mindfulness into the cognitive behavior therapy techniques. We actually do that in COPE. We also teach mindfulness. We know the two most wasted emotions are worry about what's going to happen in the future and guilt about what's happened in the past. So if we can teach people how to stay more in the present moment, it really helps with those negative emotions. And we do that as part of COPE.
Is that something that younger people take to very easily, or do they think it's kind of hooey or what?
No, we actually also teach children down to 7 years of age these particular techniques. And research has shown when mindfulness or meditation is integrated with CBT, you don't get as much recurrence of depression. So there's better long-term positive effects when you integrate mindfulness into CBT.
So mindfulness slash meditation meditation. It's not something a lot of times people think, well, I don't have time to get into meditation. That takes time and takes classes and that kind of thing. And really, there's some very simple forms that people could adopt.
There is such simple forms. I'm going to give you an example, and everybody could do this.
Can I do it right now?
If you have a piece of gum and you can do it. So one of the easy tasks that I ask people to do to start to develop mindfulness, chew a piece of gum and count how many chews it takes before it runs out of flavor. When you're doing that, you can't be worrying about what's going to come or guilt about the past. So I do these simple training exercises that don't take that much time to learn those techniques.
And it has the same effect.
Absolutely. We now have 14 studies that show the positive outcomes of teaching mindfulness integrated CBT.
We didn't used to have to be taught stuff like this because we had time built in. We weren't running around like chickens with our heads cut off.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's nothing more important, though, when you look at the numbers of people today affected by stress, anxiety, and depression. There is nothing more important than learning these skills. We also know when teens learn these skills, as we showed in our NIH-funded study, they had higher academic competence. Their grades were higher. So in addition to healthier behaviors, there's a strong link with academic performance.
I'm wondering about test taking especially.
Absolutely. Because in this program, we teach students, again, how to regulate anxiety, how to regulate stress. So those definitely have payoff in terms of academic performance.
Carolyn in Pickaway County, I assume. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Yes, it is Pickaway County. I am a graduate of the OSU Nursing College, and listening to this discussion, I'm wondering about the opportunity to get this training for myself. I live very close to a depressed small village area that has a community center, and I would just thrill to be able to offer this program in the community center, if that's possible.
Well, I am so happy to hear from one of my alums. So thank you for calling in today.
You're welcome.
Why don't you just contact me at melnyk.15@osu.edu.
That's
M-E-L-N-Y-K.
Yeah,
correct. Yeah. At osu.edu. Yep. So just reach out to me. We actually did a study in rural Appalachia.
Okay.
Testing this program with eighth graders with similar positive outcomes. So one of my PhD students, Jackie Hoying, just finished her dissertation administering this program to sixth graders in Columbus City Schools with fantastic outcomes, including a decline in suicidal ideation from sixth graders who started the program thinking about suicide.
Carolyn, thanks for your call, and good luck with your program there. This can affect a lot of people. It seems sort of like a luxury to others to have these kinds of programs out there. I was wondering if you could talk about what the suicide rates are among people in that, why this is important, particularly at that age group level.
You bet. Suicide remains the third leading cause of death in 14 to 24-year-olds. So again, if we can, one, teach kids these skills as a prevention strategy, hopefully we'll see less depression, because we know depression is the leading cause of suicide. So the key is to screen children and teens for depression. In fact, the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends screening in primary care all 12 to 18-year-olds for depression. But they also say when systems are in place to accurately diagnose and treat. And I will tell you, a lot of primary care practices,
pediatricians, mm-hmm, yeah,
and pediatric nurse practitioners feel they can't screen on a regular basis for depression because they don't have enough mental health providers to refer people to. We have long wait lists right now. Kids, teenagers are waiting 3 and 4 months to get in.
Why is there a shortage?
It's interest. It's trying to get more people interested to go in this particular field.
Why? What do you know about that? From your psychiatry and child psychiatry is your background.
Yeah, absolutely. I love mental health.
Yes.
And so it's always been a passion of mine, but there's still a lot of stigma around mental health. And when people are considering career pathways, I know at least for many nurses, they envision being a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, being inpatient, mm-hmm, with severely, okay, affected people. Whereas we know there is such a need out in primary care. Nationally, the government, our feds, are emphasizing how important it is to integrate mental health into primary care settings. So I am hoping from my role modeling, from my advocating, from my teaching people about the need and what we can do out in primary care, school settings, communities, we can get more people interested in this. But again, through a program like we've developed, you don't need that psychiatry degree to be able to teach children important cognitive behavioral coping skills. Mm-hmm. I can teach teachers and nurses and social workers how to deliver this program because it's manualized.
To what extent is it a benefit that the kids are all in the same room together versus isolated with a psychologist, maybe lucky enough to have a therapist working with them? But is there a benefit?
Well, I think it normalizes it.
Okay.
You know, if a child, you know, needs to go to a therapist, right, they're often skittish those first couple of visits, and you sit looking at them and often try and pull out what
they're
thinking.
I can't even imagine what it's like to be a child psychiatrist.
And feeling. And I'm not saying this should replace therapy at all. So, mm-hmm, I want people to understand that. But these are skills that, again, every child, teen, college student, and adult can learn. They are coping skills, again, that everybody needs to deal with stress and anxiety and depressive symptoms in their lives.
This program has been around for a while.
Almost 30 years.
Right. And so lots of studies,
yes,
have shown its effectiveness. It's evidence-based. How long do you think you have to go before you reach sort of that point where it's more accessible to more and more, to enough people?
Absolutely. One of my dreams is to start a nonprofit mental health foundation for children and teens, just because less than 25% of children with mental health disorders get treatment. And again, whatever I can do to help more kids and teens get these skills, I'm passionate about it. I want to devote, you know, a huge part of the rest of my career just helping children and teens and college-age youth get these skills.
Well, thanks for joining us, as always, Bernadette Melnick, to talk about it today.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Dr. Bernadette Melnick. She's Dean of Ohio State University's College of Nursing. She's Chief Wellness Officer for Ohio State University. And somehow she also finds time to do studies. We were just talking about the most recent study. It's called about a program. The Journal of School of Health recently published it. It's called Creating Opportunities for Personal Empowerment. We'll have a link for more information on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shia Lynette, All Sides interns Trent Lammers, who's leaving us today. Trent, good luck in the future. Thanks so much for all your help on the show. Also, Ryan McFadden and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.